Well, let's see if I remember how to do this. I haven't preached in 7 weeks, believe it or not, which I think is the longest stretch I've ever had since coming to Oceanside, but lots of good reasons for that. So to make up for it, I'm going to preach at least a full hour today. And No, it's only going to feel like an hour. But of course, it speaks to really the health of our church, the fact that we have, you know, four very qualified, capable people on our preaching team right now is amazing for a church of our size and sets us up for long-term health as we go forward, because you don't want to be dependent on one or two people or personalities in a church. And I feel really the past 2 years we've made amazing strides just building a certain culture that is spread out among a certain kind of people, so that matter who is speaking or who is leading music or who is doing whatever, it still has the same heartbeat of our church. So I'm just so excited about where we are as a church, where we're going, and next week we'll make some important and exciting announcements about some things happening, so please be here for that. But one of those exciting developments is that we finally finalized and approved our core values earlier this month, which was the last step in a year-long process of establishing our vision, our mission, and our values together. And they're now final and on our website, and you'll be seeing and hearing more and more of all of those. And as we hinted in my message 7 weeks ago, the heart of hospitality, one of those core values is hospitality. And what we have more specifically named mutual hospitality. So you can listen to that sermon online or on our app for kind of an in-depth overview of the heart of hospitality. But here's the description of that, and it will apply to our text this morning. So mutual hospitality as a value, here's how we describe it. That we desire that all feel welcomed, loved, and accepted here. The God of hospitality calls us to open our doors and our hearts to one another. By mutual, we mean that hospitality is a two-way street, as we allow ourselves to be transformed by both giving and receiving, making ourselves vulnerable to each other, listening and confessing our sins to each other, forgiving each other, and bearing one another's burdens. Biblical hospitality causes us to treat each other with humility and compassion, considering others better than ourselves. As in the early church, the message of forgiveness through Jesus and experience of the Spirit overcomes gender, racial, age, and socioeconomic barriers, so that we testify to God's kingdom by bringing and binding people together who might not otherwise seem to have much in common. So that's our vision when we say mutual hospitality as a value, what we want to embody as a church. So biblical hospitality goes way beyond just preparing desserts and coffee for each other, although that is very much included in it. But hospitality is a part of the character of God, how he interacts with us in the world, and something we are meant to reflect then in our behavior. So I want to continue some of the themes begun in the last sermon by looking at a familiar story, one that illustrates this radical, transformative, and at times scandalous mutual hospitality, the story of Jesus and Zacchaeus in Luke chapter 19. And I want to look at three main sections of this text, which are on your bulletin, but we want to first do a profile of Zacchaeus in verses 1 through 4. And then in verses 5 through 8, we'll look at Jesus as guest. And then in the last two verses, we'll look at Jesus as host. So let's start by giving a profile of this man, Zacchaeus. Verses 1 through 4, Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. So in these first couple of verses, we learn three key things about Zacchaeus that help us understand the power then of the rest of the story. So first, Zacchaeus was a chief tax collector. Not only a tax collector, but chief, meaning he had others under him and oversaw the tax collecting operations. If you're a Bible reader, you know that a tax collector was a despised profession for a Jew because it caused one to collude with the hated Roman government that occupied the Jews. And so as chief tax collector, Zacchaeus would not even really have been considered a true Jew, which is probably behind the statement in verse 7 where they call him a sinner. He's an outcast. He's an embarrassment to other Jews. One commentator calls tax collectors like Zacchaeus the arch villain in Jewish society. So first, he was a chief tax collector. Second, we learn that he was wealthy. Jericho was a very wealthy district at that time, so it makes sense. If he was the chief tax collector of that district, he also would have been quite wealthy. Lots of money coming in and changing hands. And then thirdly, we learn that he was short. The translations say short in stature, or it gets translated different ways, but it's likely referring to some sort of actual dwarfism. According to Leviticus 21:16-24, dwarfism was actually considered a deformity or a defect that would disqualify any priest or person from offering the sacrificial food or even come near the curtain of the altar of the Holy of Holies. As you might know from other parts of the gospel, Jews often associated outward deformities with some sort of inward or result of sin. So you have the story in John 9, right, where Jesus went along, he saw a blind man from birth, and his disciples ask us, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents?" Simply because he was born blind. This may be part of the accusation, again, in verse 7 of this text, which where Zacchaeus is called a sinner simply by his physical deformity. Sin is assumed. Furthermore, the stereotype, for lack of a better word, in the first century Greek world, so getting away from just Jewish tradition, the Greek world often associated also outward traits with inward morality. So the Greeks often viewed small people as small-minded and greedy, and so there was this prejudice built up against those who were short, like Zacchaeus. And so imagine the life of Zacchaeus growing up. He's made fun of. He's ostracized. Probably never invited to social gatherings. Likely struggling with self-esteem. Living a life of discrimination. And so Zacchaeus turns his pain into ambition. He finds himself in a hated profession, perhaps one of the only jobs he could find. And in his loneliness and perhaps out of his bitterness, he becomes driven and moves up the social ladder, all the way up to chief tax collector, not the social ladder, but that the tax collecting ladder, and becomes quite wealthy, which likely only increases people's resentment of him. And so due to his physical and social status, we can guess that he was quite isolated despite his wealth. And so as Jesus approaches the crowd, Zacchaeus, you imagine, is likely getting pushed around, told to get out of the way, being called derogatory names, and in his shortness, he's completely hidden from view. And nobody's saying, "Hey, make room for Zacchaeus." No, they don't care. And so he runs ahead to a sycamore fig tree, a strong tree with a short trunk with sturdy branches, optimal for climbing. And we can feel the people sneering at Zacchaeus and laughing at him as his awkward body runs ahead to the sycamore tree, something only a child or an undignified person would do, climb a tree. And yet he risks this mockery. This wealthy man is willing to make a fool of himself by doing something extravagant and perching on a tree. Why? Because he wants to see Jesus. All this just for a glimpse of Jesus. It's a challenging application here, of course. That are you so desperate for even just a glimpse of Jesus that you would be willing to make a fool of yourself, be mocked by others, just to hear his voice, to see his face? Or are you playing it cool? Are you standing calmly in the crowd, waiting and seeing what this Jesus has to say for himself, making sure you note the things that you don't like about what he says or does? Do you come to church just to be seen? to hear some good songs, to calmly assess the preaching? Or do you come with a heart of desperation that would take just a crumb from the Lord's table if you could get it? Just a drop of that living water. Are you so desperate for Jesus that even if the music is bad or not to your liking, or the preaching is terrible, or the volume is too loud or too soft, or this or that person annoys you, you're so hungry for Jesus that you will gather up anything you can get just for that brief glimpse of Him? When's the last time you did something extravagant just to get a glimpse of Jesus? When's the last time you got on your face, on your knees, carved out some time, fasted, prayed, maybe just lifted your hands in surrender, humbled yourself in some way to press in, close our eyes, anything for more of the Spirit of God? I'll be honest, I've almost never met an altar call that I didn't not necessarily for salvation, but just to seek more of the Lord that I didn't respond to. And it's a huge part of my spiritual formation, spending countless hours in my youth and young adult years in particular, praying at steps like these, seeking the Lord, being the last to leave. I mean, I was a worship leader's worst nightmare, because you often instruct them, right? Don't stop playing until everybody, you know, that's your ministry to them, until everybody's done seeking the Lord. And I would just often be the last person, even as sometimes my non-Christian friends I invited maybe looked on and didn't understand that it looked like I was making a fool for myself, but so hungry, desperate for the presence of God. One glance from Him. But as I've been around the church longer and get older, I'm more tempted to play it cool, to stay reserved, keep it intellectual, evaluate what's happening with the dispassionate eye of a critic. After all, I'm a well-educated, ordained minister. I have a reputation to keep. But I fight it, and I do fight it, because deep down, I want to be like Zacchaeus. I want to be willing to make the effort to be a fool just for the chance of that one glimpse of Jesus. For that is what I was made for. That is my chief vocational calling, is as a lover of Jesus more than anything else. So why is Zacchaeus so determined to see this man? What is he drawn to? Well, he's probably heard the rumors of this Jewish prophet who welcomes the social outcasts like himself, who has compassion on the oppressed, the sinner, and offers the kingdom of God to those who were previously left out, like Zacchaeus. And he wonders, could the rumors be true? And so Jesus approaches. Zacchaeus likely wonders, should I say something? Will he notice me? And so we come to verses 5 through 8. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today. So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, he has gone to be the guest of a sinner. But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount. So let's look now at Jesus as guest. A lot happens in these few verses, and I'm going to organize it by describing how watching and experiencing Jesus as guest challenges how we assess our priorities, people, and possessions. So let's start with priorities in verses 5 and 6. Almost all the stories of hospitality in the Bible and the ones I've shared with you hold this in common. They are somewhat spontaneous, meaning it has to be a lifestyle and a reflection of our hearts and our priorities. That we read in verse 1 that Jesus was just passing through Jericho. Not only that, Jesus is on his way to and nearing Jerusalem, where he is about to suffer and die. The Last Supper is only about a week away. The triumphant entry takes place at the end of this chapter. That Sunday is only days or hours away. This is one of the last stories, encounters before Jesus enters Jerusalem, where he will die. Who will he spend his time with? And it would be excusable for Jesus to be a little preoccupied, a little too busy. You know, hey, Zacchaeus, I appreciate your enthusiasm, but I got somewhere to be. You know, the sins of the world, they're kind of depending on me this week. I got some important things to do. They need taken care of. I'm sure you understand, Zacchaeus. No doubt his supporters likely had their list of scheduled activities for Jesus. At 11 a.m., he meets with town leaders, noon at a trendy lunch place, 1 p.m. with local religious leaders, and is quickly off to Jerusalem where important business awaits. But Jesus will have none of it. It's not how he operates. Hospitality is not a very calculated spiritual discipline. In Genesis 18, Abraham didn't know he was about to receive guests and angels from the Lord and the Lord himself. But he didn't say, you know, this is a bad time, guys. I didn't know you were coming. I got a lot going on. I'm sort of trying to start a group of people to save the world eventually. No, he quickly hurries out to meet them, offers them rest, the finest food, foot washing. You might know the story. The problem is we are just too busy. We are too preoccupied with other priorities to practice hospitality to strangers. But as long as we remain too busy with our own pursuits, we will not be able to act out God's heart of hospitality the way he intends. Are you willing to make some life adjustments so that the heart of hospitality, which is the heart of God, can grow in you? Jesus' willingness to become a guest in the home of lowly Zacchaeus challenges our priorities, our sense of importance, and also to reevaluate our thinking in verse 7 about people. It's hard to communicate how scandalous Jesus' act here is. I mean, Zacchaeus is a hated man who is believed to be cheating his fellow countrymen by colluding with the occupying Romans. I mean, it's embarrassing enough that Jesus actually stops and talks to Zacchaeus. Everyone was probably like, Jesus, what are you doing? You know who that is? That's Zacchaeus. He is the chief tax collector. You don't have to stop and talk to him. But man, you got to love Jesus. You just see this over and over again, right? Not only does he stop and talk, but he openly announces in front of everyone that he will forgo time with perhaps some of the who's who of Jericho that were following him in the crowd, and instead he will visit this sinner's house, a home no doubt despised by those in Jericho, for it was built with their very own tax money. And presumably, as would be the custom, he will share a meal with him, the ultimate act of fellowship. And so you understand then, right, the grumbling of verse 7. All the people saw this and began to mutter, he has gone to be the guest of a sinner. You feel the indignation when you understand who Zacchaeus is. As is so common in Luke, there are really three parties in this story, the way he tells it. There's Jesus, there's the person he's interacting with, but then there's those around who observe, who comment, and who respond, whom we ultimately can place ourselves with and whom are meant to challenge us with the question of what we would do. What is the condition of our hearts? And so we're faced with this Jesus, once again humbling himself as guest. And as usual, Jesus, he totally violates our sense of propriety and godliness. He makes us uncomfortable. His behavior seems completely unfair. I mean, after all, just in the previous chapter in Luke 18, Jesus just sent away a respected wealthy ruler, the rich young ruler, and he sent him away sad and told him to sell all his possessions. And yet he welcomes this wealthy tax collector? What is our reaction? Are you really comfortable with Jesus and his ways? Or would you be disturbed, even disgusted, with how he operates if he lived and moved around Arrington, Parksville, and beyond? Would you even notice him? Would he notice you? Would he be in the kind of places that Jesus would be found? Are you scandalized by the wide embrace of Jesus? Do your prejudices keep some people outside of the reach of Jesus? I mean, if you were Jesus coming into Jericho, riding a wave of support and popularity, what would you have done? Would you wine and dine with the powerful and influential, visiting important people and places? Surely people were clamoring for Jesus to do so. No doubt his supporters were hoping for a positive photo op showing Jesus' popularity and power on this important stop on the way to Jerusalem. But Jesus instead chooses to spend his time at the home of Zacchaeus. A while back, I spent back-to-back summers in Vietnam doing missions work. I've talked about it here and there, doing just mostly relational and friendship evangelism. And it's the most challenging thing I've ever done, which is why I tell stories about it. I'm not really exaggerating when I say we got there and we got to the missionary's house and they said, well, this is a closed country. It's communist. There is no real organizations or anything like that. So go make some friends and earn their trust and then tell them about Jesus and then invite them over and we'll go from there. And that was my assignment for a couple months, me and my friend, to go make friends and tell them about Jesus. And just amazing things happened, and we invited a lot of people into our space where we were staying. We had Bible studies. We showed the Jesus movie in Vietnamese, all kinds of things. But it was usually most powerful when we went to their homes, often on a spontaneous invite. And that's usually where the most powerful conversations were. Think of my friend Henry, who due to his vulnerability and poverty had gotten into the world of what was essentially homosexual prostitution, borderline sexual slavery to older, mostly Western men. And he was so broken. I could tell he was despised by his fellow people, sort of like Zacchaeus, for they knew what he did, pleasing wealthy tourists who preyed on the weak. His people knew what kind of person he was. He was an extremely feminine. He was poor. He was dressed oddly. He had zero self-esteem. And I admit I sometimes felt embarrassed when I was out with him because I could feel the looks from other people, some probably even questioning me and my motivation and who's this white Westerner spending time with the scum of Ho Chi Minh City. But we were able to befriend Henry. Both years, the moment that most stands out to me are the times in his home. And I use that term lightly because when I say home, I mean a concrete block in the slums of Ho Chi Minh City, the poorest urban area I've ever been in by far. If you've ever been in those maze of concrete blocks, no doors, no nothing, just a couple of walls. I won't tell you about the terrible food we had to eat or sitting on a cement floor on newspaper, but the conversations we got to have about the love of Jesus for him. And it's because we were willing to treat him as important, even be a guest, just as Jesus does with Zacchaeus here. But you don't have to go to Vietnam. Even here in the Oceanside area, I've been in some homes that are about as small and filthy as you can imagine, sometimes barely able to breathe. People that wouldn't even really be able to get to our home, probably wouldn't be comfortable coming to our church even, and particularly probably not even my own house, I'm ashamed to say. So the willingness to be a guest becomes so important. Jesus brings Zacchaeus from the margins to the center by allowing him the honor of hosting Jesus. And we as a people and as a church should have a similar mission. I think of the practice of the La Arche communities and Jean Vanier, if you know about them, the bios in the library in the biography section. But they say always give central place in the community to the mentally or physically challenged persons. And I would add spiritually challenged to that. The upside-down kingdom of God. Those who everyone thought were outside or ought to be outside, like Zacchaeus, are now inside. And those thought to be inside find themselves in these stories on the outside. Jesus is just too uncomfortable for them. They prefer to stick with their safe and secure world where they know who's in, who's out, based on what they do and don't do and who they are. But Jesus challenges our assessment on who God deems important, who he values, by paying attention to and spending time with Zacchaeus. And then lastly and briefly, when we invite Jesus into our lives as guests, it changes our idea of our possessions. So verse 8, but Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, after this transformation, you can imagine, of hosting Jesus as a guest, look, Lord, here and now, I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount. I won't get too into this. It's not perfectly clear if the first part is an actual change in Zacchaeus. The verb in the Greek is actually in the present. So he may just be saying, hey, I give all of half of my possessions. He may just be saying, I'm not such a bad guy, actually, as everybody thinks I am. It's not clear. But I do think, especially the second part of the verse, but probably all of it, are evidence of a transformation in Zacchaeus as he opens himself up by giving hospitality and in return receives the transforming hospitality of God. Notice the mutual hospitality taking place. Jesus is hospitable to Zacchaeus, paying him attention in front of others. Zacchaeus then offers hospitality to Jesus. Jesus is willing to be guest and, as we'll see in a short moment, then becomes the host. But all this hospitality is transformative. The giving and receiving that takes place bears fruit in Zacchaeus and potentially transforms him, particularly in the area of his possessions and his wealth. See, his reconciliation with God produces the motivation for reconciliation with others. And this is important. Salvation is not just a vertical experience between you and God that has no effect on others, but it has relational impact on those around you and how we interact with those, and particularly those in need, with our possessions. So there's a relational dimension to salvation. Thus, hospitality, open hearts, open homes, open lives toward others becomes a way of life as the fruit of salvation. Accepting Jesus involves getting right with those around you. And if you're going to invite Jesus in, you better hold real loosely to your possessions. And your time, and your money, and everything else. Can you imagine the cost to Zacchaeus here? A wealthy man, half his possessions? Jesus' radical openness and hospitality should produce the same in his followers. If not, perhaps we have not fully understood and experienced God's radical generosity and grace toward us. Let's close with Jesus as host. Jesus turns the tables. He comes as guest, but now he will be the host, offering something to Zacchaeus. And Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house. For this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. And you see how this story embodies that so well. Jesus came to earth and to Zacchaeus as a guest in order then to be host, so that he might offer the radical hospitality of salvation to any and all he chooses. Jesus calls Zacchaeus a son of Abraham, meaning a full member of the community, no lesser status, and Jesus therefore becomes the host by inviting Zacchaeus to now experience the fellowship and salvation of God. The one who has given hospitality to Jesus, Zacchaeus, is then drawn into the much wider hospitality of God, a transformative exchange of hospitality. And we see this all over Luke and all over the Gospels. And as Christ bearers, we're challenged to follow this example. See, I came to Henry's house as a guest. But as we finished dinner and we reclined and sat around talking, as the conversation turned to Jesus, I quickly became the host, explaining to him the forgiveness of Jesus, even for one as despised as him, offering salvation to him, inviting him into the kingdom of God and the family of God. See, when we practice this mutual hospitality, salvation often comes to the least expected and least expecting. No one is too short, too much a sinner, too far outside of God's reach. Jesus' proclamation in verse 9 tells those in the crowd and us, the reader, that to embrace Jesus is also necessarily to embrace those like Zacchaeus. Those physically, mentally, spiritually, and otherwise impaired. The lost, those like Zacchaeus, without a community, are given a family. The hospitality of Zacchaeus and his household and his corresponding repentance has changed their status and their eternity forever. I'm going to invite the band to come back up. As I said a few weeks ago, hospitality and salvation are interrelated. Salvation is being welcomed into the community of faith, and salvation is hospitality in that it is accepted most easily by those who need it and know they need it, especially the weak and downtrodden and humble of hearts. So Jesus goes to the big and small, the rich and the poor, anywhere there is brokenness, hurt, and pain. And so the question for you is, will you go with him? And if you've never invited him into the home of your heart, will you do so? Like Zacchaeus in verse 6, will you welcome Jesus gladly and allow his transforming presence to take place in your hearts? And if you want to, you might need to do something extravagant like Zacchaeus. Maybe like telling a friend, telling one of us, hey, I want to invite Jesus into the home of my heart. First as guests, but then to also be host of my life and Lord of all. There's nothing stopping you from doing that. You don't need special words. You don't need a special presentation. You just need to open up your hearts to Jesus. Where your life and our church be one, where the lost find welcome and hospitality and find the wide embrace of God. So will you seek the Lord with me for just a few minutes to seek his heart, to pray for this transformation in our own hearts? Like Zacchaeus, are you desperate for just one glimpse of him? What would you do for just one word from Jesus' lips? We stand with me if you're able. Hopefully this message just hits some place in your heart. For everyone, it's different. I don't pretend to be the Spirit of God. He is working in his unique way in your heart. But would you tell him what's on your heart? Confess any places the Spirit is convicting you in when it comes to this sort of radical hospitality of Jesus. Our goal for you as pastors and leaders is for you to be able to say, I love the way you think, Jesus. Maybe to not be offended when you come face to face with Jesus, but instead to say, I love your heart, God. I love your beautiful heart, your heart for the lost, your heart for those like Zacchaeus, when everyone else was sneering, was laughing, was ignoring this man. Jesus threw all the attention, all the love of heaven upon him, and it transformed his life. It transformed his heart, and Jesus is still doing that today. He longs for your neighbors. He longs for that estranged family member He longs for those who are hurting, who are forgotten, who have been marginalized by society. He loves my friend Henry. But as you know, Jesus is no longer here on the earth. Instead, he has sent his spirit to be alive in you, and now he sends you as his representative into the tough places, into the dark places, into the broken places, into the grocery store, into the library, into your place of work, into your neighborhoods, into the parks, into those family gatherings, into the sidewalks, into the streets, into the trailer parks, into the tents. God, forgive us that we are just too busy and preoccupied with our own importance sometimes. Let us not see interruptions as interruptions to our work, but rather let us see them as our work. We long for divine interruptions. We long to have a heart just like Jesus, where he says, I must go to your house today. Everything else is off the table for this divine encounter. Want to kneel, if you want to move around, if you want to come up here as an extravagant act before God and just say, there's no tree to climb, but there's an altar to kneel at. Face to face with Jesus, with his beautiful ways, with his challenging actions.